Gregory is McKelvey Curator, International Art at Auckland Art Gallery. To many of you, probably all of you, she needs no introduction. I've already heard from a couple of people who recognise the voice, and we're glad to meet the face. She speaks on Kim Hill very often, about historical art. She's your go-to person for anything related to European historical art in New Zealand, and is currently working on a book and show with the working title Masterclass, which surveys 5 centuries of European art in New Zealand collections. And there's a lot more of it than you might think. So Mary's going to address those aspects of our collection, and I'm certainly looking forward to that.
Okay, everybody's settled. Now, first of all, I have to thank Christchurch, because not only for inviting me down to speak today, but also for actually rekindling my interest in Dutch art, because much of the study that I had done historically was actually in Italian art. And we have one or two examples of Dutch art in our own collection in Auckland, but not the sort of richness that you have in this collection here. And the interesting thing about the Dutch paintings is that they are all on quite a small scale. So you're going to have to trust me today. And what you're going to have to do later is come up and examine the paintings closely. And really what I sometimes think you need with paintings such as these is a magnifying glass, because they are absolutely brimming with marvellous little details that at first glance you might not pick up on. Now, Dutch art stands out in the 17th century, partly because of what had been happening historically. Holland had become a Protestant country, so religious paintings were banned. And so artists were forced to be much more creative about their subject matter. When John Evelyn, the English diarist, went to Rotterdam in August 1641, there was their annual fair taking place, and he couldn't get over the number of stalls selling paintings. It was something that you had to wait until the 18th century to happen in England. But Holland was becoming a wealthy country. People who had land couldn't often expand when they had extra money. So buying paintings became a very interesting hobby, which clever people realised that would eventually go up in value. So these art fairs weren't just works being sold by the original artists, but they were also people doing a deal and buying up, if you like, selling off old works and buying up others. Now, the subject matter of Dutch art inevitably turned to the country itself and to the activities of ordinary people. And that is what is really celebrated in this particular group of works here. One beautiful little landscape by Habema, who studied under Rysdale, the great Dutch landscape painter. They were great friends. They used to go out into the countryside for trips together. And Habema is thought to have painted at least 30 paintings of water wheels or water mills. And that's exactly what you can see in the background in this painting. You really have to get close to it. But it encapsulates many of the new approaches to landscape painting that were taking place in the north. Whereas in Italy, the great focus was on looking at classical ruins. You've got a lovely little example of the Colosseum up above the painting after Vernet of the Bay of Naples. But what artists did in Holland, and to a degree in Flanders, was to look at the real world, to study real plants, to make animals the subject of paintings. The two little paintings of the horse and the cow there fit into a very broad category, a very popular category of animal painting. And this is very cleverly constructed, this painting. And if you look at it, you can see that it's made up of planes of colour. The light falls in the middle, so that helps to draw your eye into the landscape. There's a church and a little village in the background, and a path meanders through. And if you look really closely, you'll see that there's actually a man fishing here. So it's like there's little tiny details in the landscape that take your eye, but you never pick them up straight away. You pick up on one, and then your eye wanders. There's a couple here chatting on the path. Are they going to turn and come towards us? Are they going to go to the farm? Are they going to go to the village that's in the background? And for the people of Holland, they looked at these paintings and they knew absolutely that they were looking at their land, but also at, you know, a peasant who worked the land, who didn't even own land, who worked for somebody else, could enjoy looking at these little paintings because they would be hung in farmhouses and in everybody's homes, even if you couldn't own one yourself. Whereas these other three paintings are genre paintings. And of course, the great masterpiece amongst this is Gerard Dow's The Physician. Now, he painted numerous versions of this particular subject. There were two kinds of doctors he painted, the real physician and also the quack, or the quacksalver. And the quack, of course, as you can imagine, was the person who set up his stalls beside the road, made up potions from God knows what, and if you were lucky, you didn't die from taking them. Whereas we know straight away, looking at this painting, that the doctor, the physician, has studied medicine. Because in the foreground, in this niche, and this was a favourite format of Dow's, this idea that you're looking through a window from our space into an inner room. But you've got Vesalius's book 7 of his studies of anatomy, which is on the bones, ossa, it has written on it. And you've also got, on the ledge here, you've got a bowl used by phlebotomists, that's people who let blood. So your arm rests, because this is a great idea that you could drain nasty elements out of the body from the blood. So you rested your arm on here and a little cut was made in your vein and you bled suitably. When the bowl was full enough, they allowed you to stop. Dow has actually painted himself in this painting. Now, the gleaming colours in this work come from two sources. First of all, it's painted on copper. Now, when you use oil paint on canvas, even though you've laid down a ground, it's going to soak into the canvas and the colours inevitably become slightly dimmed. But when you paint on copper, the paint gleams like enamel. And inevitably, paintings on copper were often smaller because you could buy ready-made sheets ready for painting on, but they tended not to be large. But he's also a complete master in reflection, so that light bounces off the inside of the bowl. It bounces off this amazing imported jar here with a silver stopper. And he is also a master of trompe l'oeil, that notion of tricking the eye, because the carpet seems to come through into our space, a technique used by a lot of artists throughout Europe. But when you look at it, you get the sense, and of course you mustn't touch, but your eye tells you that if you were to touch, you'd get the texture of the carpet, you'd understand that woolen feeling. But you've also got classical references. Now, this is also important because in Holland, painters, partly, I suppose, because a lot of them painted genre subjects, everyday subjects, often were not considered as important as sculptors. And this was a great debate that had taken place throughout Europe, starting really from the 13th century in Italy. It was called a paragone, the debate between painting and sculpture. And a lot of clever artists believed that they could make something look like sculpture, but at the same time, it was a painted surface. And that's exactly what Dow has done here. This is a carved marble. He paints a carved marble frieze, which is actually identified. It was carved by a Flemish artist who went to Rome called Francis de Caen. And his brother Jerome brought it back to Europe, at Northern Europe, and plaster casts were made of it. So artists could buy it and have it in their studio and make close copies of it. And so he's got this classical frieze here. But he's also got this Cupid, which I think is tremendously amusing because the Cupid is looking out the window and I can almost imagine that he's whistling, saying, well, it wasn't down to me. Because what the doctor is doing is he's engaged in uroscopy. He's studying this poor woman's urine to see if he can detect from it what her ailment is. Now, one of the ailments that women went to the doctor for was pregnancy. And it's quite possible that this woman is either, and she looks very, very anxious at this moment. You know, she's got her basket with her. She may have been to the market, but she may be paying him with eggs or a chicken or something like that if she doesn't have the money, the coins to pay him. But she's gazing anxiously as he examines the glass flask of urine. Because, of course, if you had many children, to be pregnant again might be a disaster economically. But I have the sense that when you look at Cupid looking out the window, that in actual fact, she may not be married, and this is going to be a real disaster for her. Behind here, there's a globe, and it's not a globe of the world, it's an astrological globe. And on the front of it is Scorpio. And of course, the scorpion is the sign of passion. Another little hint. These paintings are often full of tiny puns and jokes that allow the educated reader to unravel the sort of subtle mysteries that are going on behind it. But it's an absolutely exquisite work. Now, just check my watch. Have I still got time? Good.
Yeah.
Yes, excellent. Now, compared to this work, when you look at Steen's Tavern Scene, it's much more obvious the kind of narrative that's going on, because everybody here is involved in having an extremely fine time. And tavern scenes were immensely popular. Often they were used, like this, all of these works in fact, as conversation pieces. If you had paintings like this on your wall, you have people to dinner, what do you talk about? You talk, in those days, you talked about the subjects in the paintings often. So it was a way of stimulating conversation. And various sort of moral themes are going on within this kind of scene of slight rivalry. You've got, if you look closely, you'll see in the background as well one man whose hand is quite firmly placed down the inside of a woman's dress. You've got a group dancing here in the background. You've also got another couple coming in the door. There's a whole lot of different activities taking place. Now, Steen actually grew up in a tavern. He actually thought of opening a tavern himself, but became a painter of tavern scenes instead. And he was important for... there hadn't been a guild of painting in Leiden for a very long time. And the guilds were always called the Guild of St. Luke, because St. Luke was the patron saint of painters, and he was also believed to have made the first portrait of the Virgin Mary. Whether he did or not, we cannot say. But you've got all sorts of other little activities taking place in here. You've also got, and the light falls very specifically on the main sort of theme or the main scene within within the larger painting. Because in the foreground, you've got a man who is obviously poor. He's got holes in his trousers and patches. His hat's slightly bent and crumpled. And he's having a very jolly time talking to this plump, rather lovely woman who's not in her, you know, she's not young. And he's offering a glass of wine to this boy who gestures to himself, "You mean me? I'm to have it." And of course, people in those days didn't drink water. Water was very often contaminated. And so wine or beer was the drink of choice, often watered down if children were drinking it. And the man has obviously had a fair amount to drink, judging by the way the beautiful flask is swinging idly in his hand. But what you suddenly notice, in amongst all of this cacophony and people carrying on, is this beautiful image of a dog. Probably slightly big for a whippet, but a whippet or a greyhound, one of those hunting dogs. And instead of looking at what's taking place within the room, his head is turned and he looks out to one side of the painting. And this was quite a common a common sort of device used by artists, because it immediately suggests to you that the painting stretches beyond the window that you see, that the world continues, just as the window always suggests that there's something out and beyond. So again, it sort of leads you to contemplate other things. Now, the third very popular theme, of course, was kitchen scenes. And many of you will be familiar with Vermeer's beautiful, sort of very still images of maids pouring milk, people carrying out simple activities. But this is now thought possibly to be by a follower of Metsu, although it is very, very similar to Metsu's work. And Metsu trained in Dao's studio. And you can see immediately the similarities in composition between the two works. Because you've got, here you have the classical frieze, the niche that frames the opening. Here you've simply got a wooden kitchen table with a range of vegetables and meat laid out upon it. Now, turnips were apparently just about the sort of national symbol of Holland because they were so common. But long carrots had only recently been introduced. Trade had opened up with the Americas and with the East, and all sorts of new and exotic vegetables were being imported into Holland. And they were often included in these still life compositions that sit in the foreground of kitchen scenes. She's a very modest little maid. Her buttons are done up. She has a neat little cap, but she looks out smiling coyly at the spectator, inviting you in. But what the painting also includes are lots of tiny still life details, a wonderful copper bucket with a landscape painted on the side of it. There's writing paper and a book in a niche above, certainly not for her to use probably, but for the master of the house. But everything is scrubbed and gleaming, whereas here you have chaos and rabble-rousing. The idea here is that this is a good kitchen. Things are looked after. Everything is in its place. Her buttons are done up. There is modesty and no naughtiness to be had. But what's also remarkable about this painting is that over the years, you can see that the underpainting, there are two figures that were part of the original composition. And one of the things that happens to many paintings over time is that the final glazes get worn away. And sometimes cleaning can do that. Sometimes simply just the way they've been stored, you know, 200 years ago, this could have been in a cupboard or a box somewhere. And the surface has come away, and you can see these ghost-like figures emerging. And of course, we never can tell exactly why the artist decided to simplify the scene. Why did he decide to take the figures out? Or are the figures painted over furniture and the furniture has come through the figure? Unless you can put something underneath the microscope and study it very carefully, it's very hard often to determine which came first. But it's a wonderful indication of the sort of thinking of the artist, because you don't get these, they're called pentimenti, which is Italian for change of thought, and you never get that in a copy, because the artist is always looking at the surface of the work and not working out his or her ideas as they move ahead with the painting. So even if this is after Metsu, it's by an original artist, and it's not copying a painting of Metsu's. It might borrow certain compositional aspects, just as has happened with this work here, but it is an original painting and an absolute little treasure. So for me, it's wonderful to see this group here. There isn't another collection in New Zealand that can put four works like this together in this way, so it is quite fantastic.
Might have time for one.
Shall I just quickly do floral still lifes? Can I scoot over here now? Of course, the other great area of painting that really reached its apogee in Holland was still life painting of flowers, floral painting. And it's interesting to compare floral painting with what was taking place often in Flanders, which remained a Catholic country. There you often get pictures of the Virgin Mary, but in a floral, with like a floral wreath around the central figures. What you've got here instead are very careful compositions, which are taken from very accurate botanical studies. But what a lot of still life artists did, floral painters did, was that they did drawings, they did sketches of flowers when they were in season or at the time that they were being imported, because there was a great flower trade in the 17th century. But so you'd do your drawings in preparation, just like you in Italy, you know, somebody like Guido Reni had folios and folios of studies of the nude and the antique sculpture and that kind of thing. So you'd have these, and then when somebody commissioned a painting or you decided that you were going to the fair and you wanted to produce some to sell, then you would make up your compositions. But in this work in particular, there are specific references to a classical tradition in that the vase is standing on a plinth. So normally you'd have a plinth with a sculpture on it. Here you have a plinth with a vase filled with this beautiful array of flowers. And what artists loved to do was to put together flowers that were out of season. Now, most of you will have heard of tulipomania, the absolute obsession with not just growing but breeding very particular kinds of tulips in the 17th century. And people would mortgage them their houses in order to buy a single tulip. And sometimes to get a corm could cost as much as buying a house. So, I mean, this was true obsession. This is sort of, you know, the diamond trade of the day, if you like. But within this work, even though you might think it's a simple arrangement of flowers, you have what is called a memento mori, because this often it's a rose, but here in fact it's honeysuckle. A piece of honeysuckle has dropped from the vase and lies at the top of the plinth. And that is to remind the viewer that the flowers will drop, that the petals will wither. And so, in other words, it's sort of a vanitas. All beauty is fleeting. Time changes everything, whether you are a flower or a beautiful woman. And so, you know, that people love these kinds of references. Whereas the little Van Rooyen painting is more in the tradition of somebody like the artist who did the first great still life painting, actually, who of course was Caravaggio. Because you have insects. And insects are both the bee, which sits on the apple, and the little bird at the top, and my mind's suddenly gone a complete blank, and I can't think of the name of it. What is it? Red. Head. No, it's not. It's got another name. It'll come to me. But it's the red was meant to be the... it was splashed with Christ's blood on the way to the crucifixion, and so it was often included in the Virgin chant. So you've got two references in here, which are subtly Christian... And historically Catholic references, but you get the little wormholes in fruit, the little insects eating away at leaves, which work in exactly the same manner as the fallen flower. So you could look at a painting like this, and you would know the cherries too were often a symbol of fertility. So that tradition goes way back into the pre-Christian period. This notion of fruit and birds being symbols of fertility and the passing of time. But they make a beautiful pair. And I have to say, it's probably a reproduction frame, but it's lovely to see a Dutch works in the sort of dark, particular kind of carved frames that they would have had when they were originally produced. So very nice combination. All right, now I'll stop.
Thank you very much, Mary. I think we'll happily take you away from Kim Hill and just have you in here every Saturday morning doing your thing.